Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. It was 50 years ago today that Sgt. Pepper's songs began to play, June 1st, 1967, and our music and culture would never be the same. I'm Glenn Moberg. The album changed a generation and provided the soundtrack for the so-called Summer of Love. It was a masterpiece of marketing, with John, Paul, George, and Ringo in day-glow costumes, surrounded by a collage of the famous and infamous. And the music was revolutionary, with new sounds, textures, and instrumentation not normally heard on rock albums. It took 400 hours of studio time to produce. As Sgt. Pepper propelled the Beatles to new pinnacles of influence, the value of items associated with them skyrocketed, as one of our guests can attest today. Noah Fleischer is the author of a lavishly illustrated book, The Beatles, Fab Finds of the Fab Four. Also with us today, Paul Kennedy, the editorial director of Krause Publications of Iola, which published the book, and UW Stevens Point history professor Nancy Lopatin Lummis, who teaches the course The Band That Changed the World. And we want to hear from you. If you're old enough to remember, we want to know where you were on June 1st, 1967, when the Sgt. Pepper's album came out, and how it affected you and your friends. If you're young, what do you think of the attention we're giving to this 50-year-old recording? Either way, we want you to call in and share your experiences with us, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. And we're going to start this morning with some housekeeping. We are not only marking the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper today, but we are celebrating the 100th birthday of Wisconsin Public Radio. We've got a centennial Simply Folk shindig tonight. That's Thursday night at the Rothschild Pavilion with two great string bands, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades and Dead Horses. Now, if you already have tickets, we look forward to seeing you, and thanks for your support. Unfortunately, the show is sold out. So if you've got tickets, you're among the lucky ones, and we do thank you for helping us celebrate our 100th birthday. And a reminder that on public television, the PBS show Sgt. Pepper's Musical Revolution will be shown this coming Saturday, June 3rd at 7 p.m. Central. So with that out of the way, thanks to all of you for being with us today. And why don't we start with you, Noah Fleischer. Your biography lists you as a lifelong admirer of the Beatles. Where were you on June 1st, 1967, when the album came out?
Well, I was still 3 years from being born.
Were you really? Okay.
I was. I was born in 1970, but, you know, my parents were Beatles fans, and I can remember my earliest musical memories are of listening to the Beatles. So they were always a huge, huge presence in my life. And though they broke up right around the time I was born, they still were very much together in my memory all the way up through my life and figured just hugely in the first, I guess I'm 47 now, it's figured hugely in the first 47 years of my life. So
that's an indication of how significant the band was, even with people who weren't alive when the band was still together.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's, I think you're seeing now the fourth or the fifth generation of people to embrace the music, and it's still, boy, it just still sounds as fresh today as it did when it came out. And we're lucky enough now to have enough time to compare it against other music and to see how it's weathered and to watch the lives of the musicians who recorded it, and it's an amazing thing and still continues to astound every time I personally listen to it.
Now, you're also the author of this lavishly illustrated volume. We've got a couple of copies here in front of us called The Beatles, Fab Finds of the Fab Four. Tell us about that.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Fab Finds of the Fab Four. Paul Kennedy, who's there, is the publisher at F&W Media, and he had the idea to do the book. In my position where I worked at the time was as public relations director at Heritage Auctions in Dallas, and we had seen an incredible amount of very high-end Beatles memorabilia show up. And the genesis of it really sprang from the sale of a copy of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from 1967, signed by all four members of the band in big, beautiful signatures. And it sold for $290,500 in 2013. And it was very clear that something had changed in terms of Beatles collecting. And they were always very collectible. But it really exploded at that point, and you began to see more and more pieces of higher quality start to show up. Instruments, early records, Ringo's collection, which sold at Julian's Auctions in L.A. All these things came out, and it energized the market for Beatles collectibles. And from that, there was so much that we began, in our discussions, Paul and I, we began to see a trend, this upward trend, and felt that there was a real story to tell about this band that hadn't been told specifically through the material record. Their history is very well known, of course, and had been explored greatly, but we thought, looking at it through the collectibles, because they were mm-hmm. musical geniuses and marketing geniuses too, and it all came together in this this one niche.
And some of these instruments are going for astronomical prices. Just judging by the price tags in your book, Ringo's original Ludwig drum set is $2,110,000 at auction. George Harrison's 1962 Rickenbacker, $657,000. And John Lennon's Gibson J160E acoustic guitar, acoustic electric, went for $2,410,000. Wow.
Absolutely amazing, isn't it? And that's really the pinnacle when it comes to Beatles collectibles, is band used gear, because there's just not a lot of it, and what there is very well documented. It's especially well documented in a book by a gentleman named Andy Babiuk in Rochester, New York. The book is called Beatles Gear, and all the Fab Four's instruments from stage to studio, and it's published by Backbeat Books. And it's a wonderful thing that he did. Is he worked with the families of the deceased Beatles, and then he worked with Ringo, and he worked with anybody that was close to them that knew the instruments to get the true story. And what you've seen is the John's J160E Gibson, which sold for $2.2 million plus a couple years ago. If that came on the market today, $2 million would look like a steal, I believe. As well as with Ringo's drumhead or anything that these guys touched. 50 years from now, it'll be selling for 4 or 5 times what it brought today.
Paul Kennedy, you're the editorial director for Krause Publications. It's a publishing house in Iola that really focuses on collectibles and memorabilia. So Noah's book seems like a pretty good fit for you.
Well, absolutely, and Noah's a perfect fit for us. I've known Noah for more than 10 years now, and we worked together actually at Krause Publications, and we worked closely together when he was at Heritage. And Noah hit it right on the nose when he said that it was 2013 when we saw the Sgt. Pepper album, autographed album, sell for nearly $300,000.
Now that was a mono album.
That's
which,
correct.
Which makes it an unusual find,
yeah,
in itself.
That was
that's a lot of money.
Yes, that was a UK release. It was staggering. And certainly what we noticed, as Noah said, is that other things came to market. And Noah's truly the expert here. I'm a fan. I pay attention to trends. I work with people who are a lot smarter than me, I just happen to be the guy who owns a printing press and can make some of this stuff happen. So when this trend, when this exploded, really, and it has exploded, as Noah points out, the high-end stuff that we're seeing sold today, John Lennon's lost Gibson guitar, the drum head that was purchased by Jim Irsay of the Indianapolis Colts for mm-hmm. $2 million plus. They're going to be in just a few years. They come back on the market and they will sell for 2, 4, 5-fold.
Paul, how old were you when the Sgt. Pepper's album came out?
Well, not good at math. You put me on the spot here, Glenn. I would have been 9 back then, I believe. So
you remember the Beatles, but it's
absolutely.
But it's not like you were an adolescent or a teeny bopper or young adult when that was happening.
Actually, my first the first record I ever bought was a Beatles 45 at beautiful Bob's Musical Isle in downtown Wausau, which is no more. I bought Hey Jude, and on the flip side was Revolution. And back in the day, you could go into Bob's Musical Isle and go in, and they had a listening booth, and you could listen to it. And if it cost me $1, it would have been a lot. I don't know what the going rate was back then, but yeah, I held on to that 45 for a long time.
Those 45s were typically $1, and you could get whole LPs in the cutout rack for about $2.98 if you went to the right place.
So the Beatles were – that was big time. I grew up in – my hometown is Mosinee, so I'm just down the road with John Altenberg, you know. And so to come to Wausau back then and to be able to listen to the Beatles 45 was pretty magical.
Nancy, LePayton Lummis, as an historian, what's the significance of the Sgt. Pepper album?
Well, the first thing it does is really transforms the Beatles as a band, takes them off the road. The idea of the album was so that they'd never have to actually physically tour again. They were going to create an alter ego band, and that band was going to do the touring for them. But it also gives them credibility as artists. This is the album where you have music critics, art critics, social commentators talking about the significance of the message of the lyrics, comparing one of the lyrics of one of John Lennon's songs to T.S. Eliot. They branch out, and they're no longer doing the teeny bopper, teenage marketing kind of pop music, but now they're artists.
There's not one of their traditional teeny bopper love songs on the entire album. The closest you come is When I'm 64, and that's about old people, you know?
And it was written when Paul McCartney was 15 years old, so it was part of his early compositions, and he brings it up to fit with the theme of we're not the Beatles, this is a different band, and we're not doing an autobiographical album, we're doing stories about other people.
My experience, I was 14 years old growing up in suburban Chicago. This album overnight made it cool to be a hippie. It jump-started the counterculture. There was already some anti-establishment fervor underway in places like San Francisco and the protests that were going on against the Vietnam War. But when the Beatles, the squeaky clean pop icons, the most popular band in the world, released this album, it was like a seal of approval. And there were obvious references to hallucinatory drugs in the album, and that did not go unnoticed. Let's listen to the second cut on the first side.
What would you think if I sang out a tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friend. I get high with a little help from my friend. Gonna try with a little help from my friend.
Well, here's lovable, unpretentious, accessible Ringo Starr singing I Get High with a Little Help from My Friends. Noah, I remember how shocking it was to hear that from a member of the Beatles when I was in high school in 1967. Your reaction to things that were on that album that were never put on record albums before?
Well, you know, it's by the time I was 7 or 8 years old when I first really started hearing those songs for the first time, and the first Beatles tune that I ever really fell in love with was Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. So, and it's well documented John said it was based on a picture of Julian's, but we all know what it's about as well. But it never bothered me, and even when I learned about it, it never bothered me because I think partially because it was the 70s and those ideas had entered, you know, the idea of things making you high and not just related to drugs. just being high on life or being high on your community or being high on whatever it was you were doing. So that was a common concept for me. But as I got older and as I listened more deeply to the music and grew and learned what the world was like, I certainly took note of those things that are in the music. And I think it speaks to the broad experience that those guys had. It never bothered me, and it doesn't bother me to this day.
And it doesn't bother a lot of people anymore, but I can tell you it certainly did at the time. If there was any doubt that the Beatles were dabbling in psychedelic drugs, it would have been dispelled with this cut.
In a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green, towering over your head.
And Nancy, as Noah just said, the acronym for Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, it's LSD, although John Lennon would later say that he wrote the song based on a drawing his son showed him.
Which was also confirmed in a famous interview with Paul McCartney, that Jillian was like 3 or 4 and came home with this painting. But what wasn't discussed in that interview was that John Lennon thought he was taking an aspirin for a headache, and it was an LSD tablet. They were introduced to LSD by their dentist at a cocktail party. And while he and George Harrison were dabbling quite a bit, and George Harrison said it was a way to get creative. He also in an interview talked about how the Rubber Soul album was the pot album, but that was like having a cups of coffee, whereas LSD was like going to the moon. But Paul McCartney stayed away from that until right before they started composing for Sgt. Pepper.
I mean, it's dangerous stuff. It's mm-hmm. very, very strong medicine. I've had mm-hmm. friends who were affected by it very mm-hmm. deeply and did not have good experiences.
Yeah. And they felt it was creative at the time, and it also came from this upper middle class, affluent, educated source. I mean, that it wasn't the teenagers that were introducing it to popular culture. It was middle class, professional Britain introducing it to them, and then they kind of introducing it to
you know, and again, this is like a permission slip almost, a green light mm-hmm. for a whole generation to start dabbling, if not in LSD, certainly in marijuana. And as a kid growing up, 14 years old, Paul Kennedy, I remember how the culture changed at that time. I remember how we had people who were greasers who slicked their hair back and carried knives and black leather jackets and kind of dangerous people. And then we had squeaky clean college prep people. And suddenly they were all growing their hair long and embracing this new culture. And it really did change a generation.
It's interesting the talk of drug use now. And certainly growing up in the 70s, it was not uncommon. As a matter of fact, it was very common to see marijuana use, you know, pot, weed, what have you.
But it wasn't before.
Well, you know, it wasn't. But let's be honest here, too. The reference to alcohol, to drugs, to sex there's a history of it throughout blues and early rock and roll. I think we're a little bit disingenuous to say that the Beatles launched all of this. I mean, it was present. I agree with you, Glenn, that certainly they gave it the springboard. It was like an atomic push out there, if you will, that they took it to everybody. But it was always there. It's always been there, and it always will be, because it is part of our culture.
Now, I remember, Noah, the mixed reactions of our parents when Sgt. Pepper came out. There was surprise and admiration at the sophistication and the quality of the music. When it came out, I remember a woman, she was in her 50s, at a music store in Palatine, Illinois, where I grew up, and she was just, oh, the Beatles, they've finally grown up. But then again, our parents were worried about this new culture and a little bit nervous that we might be getting into trouble.
Well, it was the music was so wide open and really brought rock and roll to a place that nobody had considered, it could even be brought to, let alone calling it rock and roll, because it included so many different elements and so much subtext, as Nancy so eloquently put it a few minutes ago. I think I might have been afraid of it too, and I certainly might have been afraid of the culture of it if I had grown up in a world that hadn't known that, because they from the album cover to the music to the guys themselves, they really, the impact that they had was cemented with this album, and I'm trying to think of things that impacted the world similarly artistically since, and I'm hard pressed to find something that is like this, that people
right.
will compare. The comparison is always to Sgt. Pepper's. Is you know, this is the most important album since Sgt. Pepper, or this artist made the biggest impact since the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper. You can't touch it in terms of the shockwave that it sent through our society that the Beatles were obviously building up to, but this was just the absolute pinnacle of what they were able to do and that reach. And I do imagine that what it represented, especially in terms of the counterculture, must have been quite frightening to the establishment.
Well, let's listen to another cut off the album that anticipated the generation gap that would cause children to reject the values of their parents and the heartbreak that caused in so many families. Here's Paul McCartney.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching her handkerchief. Quietly turning the back door key, stepping outside, she is free. We gave her most of our lives, is leaving, sacrificed most of our lives. We gave her everything money could buy.
This is such a sad song, and so sympathetic to the parents who are losing their daughter, who meant more to them than anything in the world. But for the daughter, well, she needed to be free, Nancy.
Well, She's Leaving Home was based on a BBC documentary that Paul McCartney saw called Kathy Comes Home, and it was discussing this epidemic that they believed at the time was teenage runaways, and going to, in the United States, Ashbury, and going to the West End of London and creating these drug communes. And so he saw that as a social problem at the time. What's interesting about some of the elements of the song is that they hire a classical harpist, and they're classical trained cellists playing this piece. And he actually talks about this to him was the follow-up to Eleanor Rigby. He wrote that as a problem of aging and isolation for the elderly population, and now it had turned to the young teenage, early 20s population who were leaving home for different reasons in isolation.
And whereas Eleanor Rigby seemed like kind of an isolated portrait of someone at the time, this struck so many families, this song.
Out of fear. I think that they saw this was the path potentially for their children, and then what do they have left? After they've raised their children and all their hopes and dreams, and then they're running away from home. So he saw it as sort of a social commentary, and that's part of what is happening. Sgt. Pepper wasn't a political album, but the events preceding the creation of Sgt. Pepper, the politics and social commentary were getting the Beatles in trouble, not just some remarks about the Vietnam War, but the album banning down in the South.
We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album today with Noah Fleischer, the author of the Beatles' Fab Finds of the Fab Four, Paul Kennedy of Krause Publications, and UW Stevens Point History Professor Nancy Lopatin Lummis. I'm Glenn Moberg. We want to hear from you. Where were you when the album came out on June 1st, 1967? And if you're younger than that, what do you think of us giving all this attention to a 50-year-old recording. 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back right after this.
Standing by a parking meter, when I caught a glimpse of Rita, filling in the ticket in a little white book. In a cap, she looked much older, and the bag across her shoulder made her look a little.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
You're listening to the Route 51 Regional Talk Radio program as we mark the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' culture-changing Sgt. Pepper's album with Noel Fleischer, the author of the Beatles' Fab Finds of the Fab Four, Paul Kennedy, editorial director of Krause Publications of Iola, and UW-Stevens Point history professor Nancy Lopatin Lummis. I'm Glenn Moberg. Here's George Harrison. Well, here again you see the experimentation that went into this album, sitars, other oriental instruments, and with them the not-so-subtle embrace of non-Western, Eastern religions, of philosophy, of Buddhism, Hinduism, and transcendental meditation. Noah Fleischer.
It's funny to think about, to hear that now, and it identified as rock and roll because it really was the first time that so many Westerners had heard sitar music, because they had all been dabbling in meditation with the Maharishi, but this moment when George brings the sitar in and when all the boys embrace these Eastern philosophies, it's obviously the high point of Eastern philosophy in the Western world, and I think that you still see the impact of that today, and you still see that the yoga is still so popular in this country, and so many Americans have turned to Buddhism and Hindu philosophies as well, and a lot of Eastern thought, and it all, I believe, really sprang out of this moment in the late 60s when these guys they opened their own minds and they opened the minds of countless millions of others to that very thing.
Paul Kennedy?
It's fascinating, isn't it, Noah, that we look back at an album released in 67 and we see today the use of world music, you know, anything that Sting has done and artists after artists have done incorporates, and you can hear the same things, and I just find it fascinating how they brought it to the forefront, and now it's commonplace, isn't it?
It sure is.
Nancy?
It's fascinating.
I'm sorry, Paul.
Well, go on, Nancy.
This is all George Harrison. He's completely solo on this song with some help from George Martin and some double track recording. The influence is totally George Harrison's. He is introduced to yoga by his wife, Patty Boyd. He goes to study with Ravi Shankar during the break in the fall of 66 before they gather together in January and start recording this album. And it's only really when Brian Epstein dies a few months after the release of this album that they then all collectively turn to an alternative and go to India and Marrakesh and start studying. But they're all fairly alienated pretty quickly. It's George Harrison who, from start to finish, is the Eastern religion influence and musical influence. And he had experimented with a number of instruments on songs in Revolver as well. But this is his solo work, really.
Let's go to Claire in Sauk County. Claire, you're on Route 51 with our guests.
Hi, Glenn. Thank you. I'm just a hair younger than you, Glenn. So I was too poor. I was only, 13 or so. I could only buy 45 until I started to be able to work after school. So I didn't buy this album until probably 1970 or so. But I remember going to the movie Help and the movie Yellow Submarine, and I've been racking my brains. Did they ever make a movie of this album? And if they didn't, it sure would have been fantastic.
Nancy, apparently they didn't.
No, because soon after this album is released is when they lose their manager. Brian Epstein dies in August. This is released, obviously, June 1st. And that's when they create Apple Corporation. They decide they're going to take over their own management of movie contracts, publishing, all of it. And that's when they start to make some bad decisions about production and animation with the music and scripts. And so this never materializes.
Claire, thanks so much for the phone call. Let's talk about this magnificent collage on the cover of Sgt. Pepper. All the Beatles were asked to contribute ideas for who should be included. George Harrison only wanted gurus, apparently. And there are 70 people on the cover, including Aleister Crowley, Mae West, Lenny Bruce, W.C. Fields, Carl Jung, the psychologist, Edgar Allan Poe, Bob Dylan, Aldous Huxley, Dylan Thomas, Dion DiMucci, the doo-wop Italian singer from America, Marilyn Monroe, William Burroughs, Laurel and Hardy, Karl Marx, H.G. Wells, former Beatles Stu Sutcliffe, Oscar Wilde, David Livingston, Johnny Weissmuller, George Bernard Shaw, Marlon Brando, Lewis Carroll, Sonny Liston, Albert Einstein, and Shirley Temple, Paul.
Pretty cool stuff, isn't it? Noah and I talked about this just recently, and I think he's got an art background, and he talked in terms of colors, costumes, mysterious title, all of this working together just from a visual standpoint. You know, imagine pulling this out of, as you mentioned earlier, Glenn, pulling this out of the record rack and holding it up and
trying to figure out who all these people were.
Yes, yes. And then if you were experimenting in some of the things the Beatles may have been promoting there in drug culture, you could have really enjoyed a different sort of perspective. But I think Noah can speak to this album.
Yeah, Noah, why don't you weigh in on this?
Well, I think what Paul said is spot on, and for me, the definition of great art is something that is fresh every time you look at it. Each time you go back, you see something new, whether it's a painting, a photograph, or in this case, an album cover. And I believe that you can name all those names, you can label all those names, you can find each of them. Turn away for a second, look back at this album cover, and it starts all over again and tells a different story, because when you're done with the people, there's the plants, there's the band themselves, and there's the picture of the band right next to the band. And so it always reveals itself completely new. Each time you look at it, exactly like it is when you listen to the album. And that's, I think it's inexorably tied into the music, but the music can't be heard without picturing this image. And that, to me, it's new each time, and that is the absolute definition of great art.
Now, they nixed some of the ideas. John Lennon famously wanted Jesus, Mahatma Gandhi, and Hitler in the collage, and cooler heads prevailed, Nancy.
Well, Peter Blake is the artist, and he's from the high-end art gallery, sort of modern age, and he had a particular vision of how he did art, which was black and white photographs that were then floral arrangements placed on top of them. So that's the premise that he introduces to them and says, give me a list of about a dozen people that you think influenced the world. So that's where these characters come from. Anybody involved in the production of the album was given this list. So what he does is he blows up life-size black and white photographs and then colorizes them. And they stayed away from controversial religious figures. But if you notice who's missing, it's all the 50s and early 60s rock influences, musical influences.
Well, except for Dion.
Except the one. And I don't know why the one got in, but that was a deliberate decision. And then to colorize the in vogue military style outfits that people were wearing at the time in the mid 60s, that's sort of a poking fun at that. But the ultimate sort of confusion here is bringing the band next to the colorized stand-up life-size placards of them next to the Marie Tussaud wax museum figures. They were all there, right front and center.
Well, let's listen to the most significant cut on the album, A Day in the Life. Here's how it starts.
He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people.
Nancy, you were mentioning that this is based on a true story.
It's based on Tara Brown, the heir to the Guinness Brewery, dying in a car accident.
Nobody was sure if he was from the House of Lords.
I think his father might have had a lifetime peerage, but this was just an acquaintance, maybe better than that, friend of John Lennon's. And he just read the newspaper article and started to compose this piece. This was one of the earliest compositions for the album, and it was designed always to end an autobiographical kind of album, because Sgt. Pepper was supposed to start with two autobiographical pieces, Penny Lane and Strawberry Field. And so this was seen as sort of the end run, and it was one of the first things they recorded, and then they had to go back and reconceptualize the entire album.
Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields were recorded at the Sgt. Pepper,
right,
but they never made it on the album.
No, they were released as a double-sided single, and that's why when we get to marketing, this is really interesting to talk about. Sgt. Pepper was facing the idea of going back into the studio after a real controversial end to the 66 tour and nobody wanting to go back and be the Beatles anymore.
They became somebody else.
They became somebody else because EMI, their music corporation, wanted another blockbuster album. And Paul McCartney, a pretty competitive kind of guy, didn't like how very well Pet Sounds from the American studio, Capitol. From the Beach Boys was doing. So he felt very competitive, both creatively. And then there was this other thing that emerged that they really didn't like, and that was the mimicking of the Beatles in the American hit, The Monkees. So EMI...
So they did something completely different.
They put them back in the studio, and so they started on this autobiographical album. And then there was this hit coming out, and George Martin said, we've got to release something. And that was Engelbert Humperdinck's Please Release Me, which beat them in the number one slot for that 45 of Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane.
Let's listen to how this particular recording ends, because it nothing like this had ever been heard before.
Now they know how many holes it takes to fill it out.
And there's the final piano note, Noah Fleischer.
Yeah, you can't hear that last chord without getting chills every single time. I don't know that there's any superlative that I could add to that. The ending of that album is just simply put the most magnificent 30 seconds in all of rock and roll, and I I would stand in Mick Jagger's living room and yell that aloud to him and the rest of the Stones.
Anybody have an idea how they recorded that sonic rush of this cacophonous dissident strings and horns all mixed together, Nancy?
Yeah, they had Paul McCartney on one piano, harpsichord, organ track, and then they had George Martin on another in a discordant key. And then they slowed it down and they sped it up and they kept on doing track after track of changing. That was one of the beauty of the Beatles and this album. They were experimenting with all sorts of new electronic technology to record. So that's – he deliberately wanted – John Lennon deliberately wanted the sound to just be an out of control, like the life out of control, the Beatles' lives out of control, if you will. Because while the song started as a remembrance of Tara Brown, it turned into something very much autobiographical for John Lennon's life.
That was great. You're spot on, Nancy. That was great. The significance of this song and this music and not to monetize anything, but I think that this can illustrate just how important this is. Back in 2010, Sotheby's sold John Lennon's handwritten lyrics to this song for $1.2 million, and in a staggering amount back then, 7 years ago, which I know would sell for more now, but that's really not the point. That just illustrates the significance of what people experienced, the brilliance of the writing,
right,
and true value.
Now, and here's a curiosity. If you listen to Sgt. Pepper's in America, what you just heard is how it ended. But if you bought the record in Great Britain, there was a strange ending to the song that started with a 15,000 hertz tone, so high that only dogs could hear it, and that was followed in the British version by this little piece of gibberish, which you probably haven't heard before if you bought it in America. And that cut was recorded on the very last tracks going into the record label. So if you had a turntable without an automatic tone arm, the sound would repeat over and over and over again. Noah Fleischer?
Wow. It's just another little piece of genius and another little gift. And, by the time I started listening to Sgt. Pepper's, that was on all of the records. And it, in my mind, I can't really hear that final chord without hearing that another, whatever it is, 10 or 12 seconds later or 8 seconds later. And I also remember that little bit of audio, too, figured very prominently in the whole Paul is Dead. There's a whole story around the whole Paul is Dead thing that went around for years,
right,
the whole story with that.
We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's with Noah Fleischer, the author of The Beatles, Fab Finds of the Fab Four, Paul Kennedy, the editorial director of Krause Publications of Iola, and UW Stevens Point history professor Nancy Lopatin Lummis. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take another short break. Here's a song off the album that was dubbed down and re-recorded 4 times on the Abbey Road reel-to-reel tape machines, resulting in 13 individual audio tracks compressed onto a 4-track recording.
Used to be angry, young man. Be hiding me head in the sand. You gave me the word. I finally heard. You're doing the best that I can. I've got to admit, it's getting better. It's a little better all the time. I have to admit, it's getting better. It's getting better.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
You're listening to the Route 51 Regional Talk Radio, 50th anniversary of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper Show.
When I get
I'd be out till 2:45. Would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Well, when I listened to that song in June of 1967 at the age of 14, I couldn't imagine that I'd be doing a radio show about it 50 years later when I'm 64. You know, Nancy, the entire album doesn't have a traditional Beatles pop love tune or ballad. This is as close as they get, and it's a song about old people.
Right. And I think, if anything, it's a love song to Paul McCartney's father, because he wrote it for him, if you will, when he was 15 after his mother had passed away. But then it turns into a sort of an autobiographical Paul McCartney reviewing where he is in 67 himself and sort of projecting him onto that pattern.
No, this was something jarring when I heard it at the age of 14. Everything was so youth-oriented at the same time at that time. And here you have Paul McCartney singing about 64-year-old people, backed by clarinets and a musical score that sounded like it was written in the 1930s.
So beautiful, isn't it? And I actually, as much as I'd like to talk about this song, I actually would like to know from you, what's it like 50 years later, hearing it when you're 64 and reflecting on that song? How does it strike you?
I feel like the end of a day in the life right now. It just blows my mind. You know, Noah, this band was also great marketers, and there was a lot of marketing that went into the Sgt. Pepper album.
They were supreme marketers, and they had always been. They had always, at least the machine associated with them is Brian Epstein. They were always tremendous marketers, and that's a lot of what the Fab Finds of the Fab Four is about, is the early years, and as they matured and as they rounded towards Sgt. Pepper's, there was they were a lot more careful about their marketing, a lot more deliberate, and I think that the record, that the popular record and the historical record and the auction record, reflects just how valued this was, because they, when it came to Sgt. Pepper, they were selling a whole revolutionary way to look at the world and to hear the world, and managed to turn it into some incredible marketing that also increased their fortunes, which nobody would blame them for, and because it was just, there was so much brilliance inside the idea of Sgt. Pepper's that everybody wanted a piece of it, and we all, to this day, will still want a piece of it. And the things most closely associated with them during this period, instruments and clothing, et cetera, is the most highly desired Beatles collectibles there are. But you can also pick up great collectibles for, $20 to $100 associated with Sgt. Pepper's, mm-hmm. that are also really wonderful pieces of marketing and intimately tied into the album itself.
Paul Kennedy, you've got about 10 seconds here.
Well, speaking of a brilliant marketing, I'd like to remind everybody that they can purchase this book at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, their local bookstore, or go to CrowseyBooks.com and check it out.
And Nancy Lopatin Lummis, do you think we'll be listening to the Beatles 50 years from now in 2067 on June 1st? I won't be, but we'll
I won't be either, but I certainly hope that people will be. It's worth listening to 50 years from now.
It's quite a band, and Nancy, as you said, they changed the world.
They did.
I want to thank all of you for being with us today. We want to thank today's guest, Noah Fleischer, the author of The Beatles, Fab Finds of the Fab Four. Also with us today, Paul Kennedy, the editorial director of Krause Publications of Iola, and UW Stevens Point history professor Nancy Lopatin Lummis. You can find The Beatles, Fab Finds of the Fab Four on the Krause Publications website. That's KrauseBooks.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Janice Schleiss. Special music today by The Beatles. Next week on Route 51, it's a conversation with former U.S. Attorney John Vaudrey, who served in the Justice Department's Western District of Wisconsin for more than 30 years. If you already have tickets, we hope to see you tonight, Thursday night at the Rothschild Pavilion, for our Wisconsin Public Radio Simply Folk Centennial Shindig. If you don't have tickets, unfortunately, that show is sold out. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we're heading out of town.